Call to order. The regular meeting of the Unalaska City Council is called to order at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, September 10th, 2024. I'll ask Councilman Coleman to read our mission statement, please.
To provide a sustainable quality of life through excellent stewardship of government.
Okay, thank you. City Clerk, may I have a roll call, please?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Bell?
Present.
Ms. Coleman?
Here.
Ms. Luby?
Here.
Mr. Nicholson? Mr. Longo?
Here.
Mr. Tungle?
Here.
Mr. Tudekoff?
Here. Councilman Nicholson is excused. Do we do have a quorum? Please join us as Councilman Longo leads us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Councilman Longo. We have visitors here this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We do have a team from P&D Engineers here this evening to present later during the work session regarding the Stores Harbor Improvement Project. So please welcome Dick Somerville and Brandon Ivanovitz from P&D and Mark Morris and Brian Myers, who are with Morris Electric as subcontractor P&D on this project. And they're down there in the front row, and they'll be presenting a little bit later today.
Well, thank you, Marjorie. Welcome to back to Unalaska. If you haven't been here before, welcome. Any further else on here? Anybody? Welcome all those in chambers, those on the telephone and Zoom. Need a motion and a second to adopt the agenda, please.
I make a motion to adopt the agenda.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Tungle, seconded by Councilman Longo. Hearing no objection, the agenda will be adopted.
Mayor, we need to add a motion to amend the agenda to add an item.
Motion to amend the agenda. Need a motion to amend the agenda.
I make a motion to amend the agenda to add executive session as requested by the city manager to discuss updates on the PSCA negotiation.
A second.
Thank you. Councilman Tungle moved and seconded by Councilman Luby to have an addition to the agenda of a special session. Let's see, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Now back to the main motion, adoption of the agenda as amended. Been moved and seconded. Moved by Councilman Tungle, seconded by Councilman Longo. Without objection, the agenda will be approved. Okay. We have a motion and a second to approve the minutes of the regular meeting of August 27th, 2024.
I'll make a motion to approve the regular minutes of August 27th, 2024.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Luby, second by Councilman Tungle to approve the minutes of August 27th, 2024. Hearing no objection, the proposed minutes are approved. Next item is reports. City Manager, I'll turn this over to Marjorie.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. As always, the manager's report is in your packet. I will comment on one item. Number two, the UMC backreach lease. That was signed with Mattson, and I spoke with representatives of Mattson today, and they just wanted to convey how pleased they were that that lease agreement for the lay down yard in the back reach was completed and signed, because they course, needed that, a long-term lease in place before they make some pretty huge financial investments. And so they wanted to thank the city for helping them get that done. And we also hope to learn about that joint application for the Port Infrastructure Development Program grant. We hope to hear about that in November to cover the costs for some of the costs for upgrading the dock and replacing the crane. Another thing I wanted to mention is the port director brought to our attention that the trustees of the Celandang IU oil spill have published a draft damage assessment and restoration plan regarding that Celandang IU accident that happened 20 years ago. I emailed that all to you today, that draft plan, and the public comment period runs through October 3rd. I just wanted to point that out. So look in your email and read through that report. And if you all want to talk about that at the next meeting, we can put it on the agenda just so it's known.
Is there any kind of study done before this letter? Did they have anything done at all?
Yeah, there's a large report that was included in the email that I sent you earlier today. What is the draft damage assessment and restoration plan?
That's 140 some odd pages, but well, we need to have a discussion on that. I don't have a problem with adding it to the next agenda for our next meeting.
Okay, we can do that.
Councilman Coleman.
The electric generation distribution system development study. Could you please remind me what capital project that is associated with?
Actually, I'm not entirely clear which project that's associated with. Is Mr. Honka on the, has he joined us? Okay, I will get that answer and I will email it out to you.
Okay.
Any further questions for Marjorie on our manager's report? It's Bill Longline.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Bill Longline.
Well, our deputy utilities director is craning his neck at me, so I will go ahead and call him up. And I didn't know he was back there in the corner. So this is Eric Hernandez, who is our deputy utilities director, and he can respond to the council member Coleman's question.
Good evening. Yeah, the EPS electric distribution and generation study is a study that we contract EPS with to evaluate the system to see what our needs are for Trident and future users on the island. I think we had a resolution that passed earlier this year in May. So we had a visit with them just last month in August with EPS and V3, who's a wind study group, to do some more evaluation of the grid and our resources here on the island.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? City manager's report. Okay, hearing none. Thank you. We also have a planning commission and planning board minutes for July 18th in the packet for your information. No presentation will be provided for this subject. Next item is community input and announcements. This is time for members of the public to provide information to the council or make announcements of interest to the community. Please come to the podium, use the microphone, state your name.
Hi, Mayor and Council, Roger Blakely, PCR Director. Just want to alert your attention to, we have a program coming on Open Mic Night. It'll be on September 26th at 7 to 9 at the Burma Road Chapel. It's a time when you can play a song, write a poem, read it, have a story. Time to come out and have a good time. And so we look forward to seeing you on September 26th, 7th to 9th at the Burma Road Chapel.
Okay, thank you.
Just a quick reminder that Friday evening at 6 o'clock in the school gymnasium is the memorial service for Matthew Leitner.
Any
Mayor, USAFE will hold their, oh, I forgot the timer. USAFE will hold their Make a Difference Dinner for Suicide Prevention and Awareness on Friday, September 27th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Unalaska High School Small Gym. This will be an evening of sharing and inspiration where you will enjoy a delicious, healthy, and free dinner. Spend time with friends and family and learn about local and other resources and discover how to make a difference in someone else's life and in your own life too. Please come, and if you have questions, call USAFE at 907-581-1500. And just like what Peggy had mentioned earlier, the Celebration of Life for Matt Leitner will be on Friday, September 13th at 6 p.m. at the Unalaska High School Big Gym. Please come and share your memories and stories about Matt. And then we'll gather at Dusty and Evie's Dickerson's house in the valley for a potluck and another chance to reminisce together. And for the clerk's office, early and absentee voting begins on tomorrow, September 11th until the 30th. So folks could absentee in person, by mail, by email, or by fax. And all they have to do is contact the clerk's office at 907-581-1251 or stop by our office. Our general municipal election will be on October 1st, 2024. That's all
I have here. Okay, thank you. Are there any further announcements for community in chambers? Anybody in chambers? Anybody on a phone or Zoom? Anyone on phone or Zoom?
No one on Zoom, sir.
Okay, thank you. Next is a public comment on agenda items. This is time for members of the public provide information to the council regarding items on the agenda. They don't want to wait until the item comes up for the regular agenda. To comment later during the regular agenda, you need to sign up with the city clerk. Please come to the podium, use a microphone, and state your name. Comments on agenda items. Does anyone wish to speak? City clerk, are written comments submitted, or does anyone in Zoom wish to speak?
No, sir. There were no written comments submitted, and no one in Zoom indicated that they wanted to speak.
Okay, thank you. Next on our agenda is a work session. May I have a motion and a second to go into a work session?
I make a motion to go into a work session.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Tungo. Dungle and second by Councilman Longo. Hearing no objection, we'll be in the work session. 6:14 p.m. First item is presentation and discussion of the fiscal policies, reserves, and fund balances with Joy Mariner, CPA, MBA, CGMA, practice leader, assurance, and principal of BDNO USA PC. Turned over to city manager.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Joy Mariner is with us tonight via Zoom tonight to discuss fiscal sustainability and fund balance planning. I just wanted to point out that the potential permanent fund that we talked about with you folks before is just one piece of fiscal sustainability. We also need appropriate policies in place, including fund balance planning. Ms. Mariner reviewed the documents presented by ABCM at the last council meeting and also listened to their presentation. So she's up to speed on what was presented at the last council meeting in preparation for her presentation this evening. And so I'll introduce Joy Mariner, who's on Zoom. And Joy, go ahead and take it away.
Great. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Very fine.
Okay, great. Well, hi, everyone, and good evening. I really appreciate you having me here with you today. And I know you have lots of big decisions coming up in this area. So I'm thankful that your team there reached out to me to see if I could provide a little more context and information for you as the council, as you're making decisions about the future of the city and how to make sure that it is fiscally sound for many, many years to come. Hopefully forever. And so really, I will, you know, my goal of this presentation is to kind of talk about sustainability policies, how those work, and how you plan for the right levels of fund balance at the city for the various activities that you're trying to do. So what I'd like to kind of start with is talk about the difference between reserves and fund balance. What do the terms even mean that professionals throw out there? I think sometimes there's different terms for bankers versus accountants. So kind of making that clear. And then what's your data look like? What does fund balance really mean? And then why a policy matters, what kind of things you might want to consider with that in terms of policy recommendations. And then we'll look at some options to consider and some examples, and then talk about what's your next step at the end. So I'd love this to be a discussion. If there's things that I'm saying, maybe, you know, please feel free to interrupt me. I know Zoom, it's hard when I can't see you to see that you want to raise your hand or ask. So please just simply, you know, let me know. And I also have time for questions at the end as well. So let's just briefly kind of talk about the difference. So fund balance is what you typically see in your financial reports. And it's really just simply the difference between what you own in a fund, which are assets, things like cash or receivables, and the difference between that and what you owe to others in a fund. So you might have advances on your grants, those kinds of things. What's left over is fund balance. It's what's kind of available after you take what you own, back out what you owe. This is what we have really in net worth. If you own a business, this is kind of the net worth of the business, you know, based on the numbers as they stand at the end of a period. There's five different categories, and this is important for our discussion. I know people don't really want to go into too much of the academics around this, but there are five different categories of fund balance. And a lot of times people are talking about fund balance, but really they just mean one category of it. Non-spendable means it's already been committed or it's already been spent. So, for example, if you've already purchased inventory or if you've advanced money from a fund to another fund, you can't spend it. It's already been kind of set aside. It's already been accounted for. Restricted means somebody from outside the city. It could be by a vote of the people, but it could also be by a grantor or a donor has restricted the use of the money for a very specific purpose or a time period. Committed means that the council has set aside the money for some reason. So what we typically see committed would be a sustainability fund, some sort of emergency fund, or if you've committed something for a specific project, we're setting aside this money for a capital budget, for example. And then assigned means that management has decided to set it aside for some reason. Sometimes that's related to budgets, maybe more specifically than what the council has set aside. And then unassigned means it's not specifically designated for a particular purpose. So the difference between an accounting term, fund balance, and what a lot of our clients use as the term reserves is that reserves is really looking at the resources overall that are available outside of the budget for use if something isn't sufficient. So if you don't have enough revenue coming in, what kind of reserves do you have in place to make sure that the budget can still work, that you can still operate the city? And so that's why there's oftentimes people talk about fund balance, but really they're talking about fund balance reserves. They're trying to figure out how much do we need to have for working capital, for example, to make sure we can pay our bills and we can pay our employees, you know, just to weather those storms and time gaps. If there's a, you know, federal shutdown or if we're going to get a delay in receiving tax revenues. That's what we're talking about with reserves. Fund balance is an accounting term. It's a simple calculation. Reserves can be a little bit more tricky and involve a little bit more strategy. So right now, when you look at your fund balance, you have four of the five categories in your general fund. I provided 5 years of data. So you can see it's fairly consistent overall in what's in kind of your different categories here, and your total general fund balance at the end of 22 is about $91 million. So when you look at the breakout of what's in that fund balance, though, in a little more detail for 2022, you can see that some of your fund balance is tied up in inventory or it's been advanced to other funds. And so it's not available right away for your use. And really, you've already committed it for other things. Committed is the wrong word. You've already essentially designated, spent it on these other things. Committed means that you as a council have made a decision to set that money aside. So you have a $25 million set aside for emergency operation, and then another million set aside for compensated absences. That's accrued leave, PTO leave for your employees. There's a small amount assigned, and then unassigned is $61.4 million. So when we talk about reserves or fund balance, having a policy is really important. So I know you've been talking with APCM. I listened to that presentation and reviewed it with your team. So having the option of potentially a permanent fund or a set aside, a sustainability fund, is an important part of the conversation. But before you make a decision on that, we recommend you have a policy or a strategy in place to really determine what that needs to be or why are you even doing it. A policy matters because it can help to help alleviate concerns about uncertainty, not having, enough reserves. Do you have enough? Do you have enough if there's a self-insurance risk, meaning there's a federal government shutdown or a change in your tax base? And I know you've seen changes in your revenue structure even just in the last year because of the fisheries tax impacts. So if you have an increased risk, you need to have a better strategy to make sure you can weather those periods of time when maybe there'll be lower levels of revenue coming in. It also, a policy instills better trust in your team here at the city and you as a council, but also your management team. It provides a better justification for holding reserves and defines a little better what those reserves need to be, whether they need to be in a permanent fund, a sustainability fund, or within the general fund like you have now in some sort of emergency reserve. It also allows kind of guidelines for management to follow. You set policy, management does the decision making, right? You make a lot of decisions for the city, but it provides those benchmarks that allow management to make the day-to-day decisions properly. A policy also can relieve some kind of resource constraints, can help you smooth risks. So if you know there's a bump 1 year or 2 years, you have a plan in place to get you back to where you want to be. And then there's a lot that's been happening. It's easier to analyze your reserves than it ever has been with technology. So it can kind of having a policy about how things work can help you leverage some of those tools. GFOA, I have a quote here because the government, this is Government Finance Officers Association. They're kind of the best practice example people. They said is it better to provide the service today or save the money for later? That's a decision you have to make every day as a council or every month in your meetings. You know, how much do we really need to have to be sustainable, but still provide the services we want for our community? And I did provide some additional resources to management in this area. Feel free to ask for those, including this, rethinking reserves document that comes out from GFOA. So if you want to do additional reading, there's lots of reading in this area. I'm happy to share with you. So their policy recommendations here basically say, at a minimum, you should have an unrestricted general fund balance. They say 2 months. Now, this is nationwide. And I would say in Alaska, that benchmark's probably more like 6 to 9 months at a very minimum. Very few of my clients are even that low, because I think in Alaska, we experience more unpredictability in a lot of things, supply chain, weather, even revenue streams, taxes, fishing. A lot of things can change from 1 year to the next, or really, frankly, 1 month to the next. But they recommend you establish a formal policy and including in that policy a process for change, what happens when this balance gets too low over time or too high over time? How would you replenish it if the resources fall below the policy? And it takes into account your own unique circumstances. So you should have a policy that's unique to Unalaska for the factors and the concerns you have as a council. And you're also looking for a strategy that doesn't address things for this year. The policy needs to be sort of a long-term forecast of what would happen for the city based on what you know now. I certainly can adjust the policy if you like. And then for you, you know, when I kind of look at your unique circumstances, some predictability of future revenues here. State budget is definitely unpredictable. Industry diversification as certain industries wax and wane. We have particular considerations in Alaska for one-time outlays, disasters, immediate needs. I think the average, I won't even guess, but the reimbursement rate for FEMA is years. So you might not get, if there was a significant event, even if it's declared a national disaster, you might not receive funding to cover those costs for years. It takes a long time to get that money reimbursed from the state and the feds. I think COVID was a little bit of an outlier. Congress made specific bills to get money in the hands of the cities really quickly. I have not seen that for lots of other disasters that have happened throughout the country. And then you're also looking at infrastructure that, you know, is very important to your industry and very important to community, but they're really expensive infrastructure assets like the port, harbor, some of the utility systems. So as those age, and we're looking long term, right? So we're looking 30 years out for a policy that can apply across that time. Is there a plan in place for capital replacement, capital improvement, and having enough resources to do that? So let's look at some options here. I'm moving along pretty quickly, but I do want to leave time for questions and also respect the time you have available. I kind of see four potential options here for your the way you would go for kind of sustainability. So a policy you do need to have in place, but what does that look like? You have lots of options for sustainability. You can kind of do status quo. That's where you have these designated reserves that we looked at, that emergency reserve. There's not a required regular recalculation of that. It's kind of this sense of we need this money set aside. We're going to vote for that. It's really simple. It's very easy to track for your management team, but it may not really address the real risks. And, you know, it's also very accessible. So that can be a pro and a con in the sense that it's just sitting there and committed. A future council could make the decision to just, you know, use it if they wanted to. It's not kind of set aside administratively. It's pretty easy to access and it's sitting in the same bank accounts as your regular money. The next level is what we kind of talk about as a reserve policy. And this is a really important thing. I recommend most of my, I mean, all of my government clients have some sort of reserve policy in place. That's really what we're talking about here. Setting a base level for how much you need in working capital, for example. How many months of expenses do you need available to cover grant costs or FEMA or some of those types of things? This is when I talk with you in the audit process. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about having, say, at least 6 months or 9 months of expenses available in your general fund. A policy in this area will provide clear parameters, a remediation plan if that number gets too low. It protects those reserves, and it can adapt depending on the budget from each year. So you don't have, you do have to redo a calculation, but it can be adjustable as you grow as a city. You can grow this number because it's a percentage usually of a calculation. However, that doesn't necessarily set you up for long-term sustainability. This is really just making sure that you can meet the needs of the city in the shorter term. A sustainability fund is the next level. This is a, you know, I think we actually have two more levels. We have a kind of a sustainability fund and then a legislative permanent fund. So let me just kind of talk quickly about the difference between the two. A legislative permanent fund is voted on by the people. It protects the principal and it can never be spent, meaning the principal itself is not accessible to the council. It's not accessible without another vote of the people. But a sustainability fund is often what most of our client, a lot of our clients call this a permanent fund. And so when I was listening to the APCM conversation, they called it a permanent fund, but I actually think what they, when I looked at the legal document that was included in their presentation, they're really talking about a sustainability fund. One of my clients calls it the permanent fund, special revenue fund, but it really, a permanent fund in accounting terms means that you can never access the principal if you needed it. It's legally binding. Where a sustainability fund takes that principle, sets it aside, it generates money that can help fund operations. It's typically sitting in a separate bank account that has better return potential and a long-term investment strategy, but it is not legally a set aside, meaning it wouldn't require the people to vote on it to release those monies if needed. So a sustainability fund to me is a really attractive option for you to build into this policy. Again, the policy needs to be more comprehensive than just a sustainability fund, but it ensures long-term sustainability. It takes funds, sets them aside. They can generate investment income. You usually get a little more long-term, you have better investment returns, and you can separately report it, separately track it. The con here is it does, if you pull it out of the general fund, it does make the general fund appear less strong. So one thing I talked about with your team is some of our clients that have these sustainability funds, they actually include it in their conversations for new infrastructure projects or grants, those kinds of things to show, you know, we have this general fund, but we also have our sustainability fund. So from a bonding perspective or a granting perspective, we're solid financially. So you need to make sure that you include the both funds in the kind of bigger financial picture. A permanent fund, as I mentioned, is a vote of the people. It protects the corpus, but it's less responsive. If you needed the money to access it for some great opportunity that's coming your way, you can't access it without waiting for a voting cycle. And there's no return advantage for a permanent fund versus a sustainability fund. So those are kind of the four things that you can consider. One thing to know is that you can actually have all four. All four of them are options. It's not one or the other. It's really all four things can work in concert with one another. So for example, you might consider to have some sort of designated reserves for your PTO for compensated absences, but also build in a reserve policy in the general fund that builds in an amount that you know you need to keep there. Maybe it's 1 year or 2 years of operations we want to make sure are accessible if we needed them for a grant or for a match or for a bond. But then you want to build in some sort of sustainability fund, and you know, want to make sure you get the higher returns for that. So you could have all three. And in fact, if the people really want something that's legally binding, you could take a portion or have a vote for a portion of that money to even go into a legally binding permanent fund. I think sometimes the bankers, as I mentioned, have different terms than we do. The APCM presentation, as far as I can tell, appears to fall into this sustainability fund category. But again, my recommendation would be a policy that builds all of the options that you think are worthwhile into a bigger kind of reserve policy for the city.
We have a question for you.
Please.
Yes, thank you, Sherry Coleman. So what makes the adaptable reserve policy different from our emergency fund? Because I know that our emergency fund at $25 million, I think, was set specifically for, you know, in case things, we are basically where our revenues cease, we need to, and I thought that was built out to for sure 6 months, maybe even longer when we set that aside.
Excellent question. The only real difference is how it's calculated. So the 25 million is just a set number. Somebody did a calculation at one point in time and said, we need this 25 million. The adaptable would say, hey, when we do our budget, we need to make sure we've got, say, 6 months based on the current year's budget, 6 months in set aside for that reserve. So it would adjust every year depending on your total budgeted expenses or revenues, usually expenses. So it's an adaptable. And then if for some reason those reserves fall below that place, it would actually build in a policy where you couldn't budget all of your revenue. You'd have to build up your reserves back up. So if there was something that happened where it wiped out a bunch of reserves, it builds a plan in place for remediating it.
Okay. So you would then advise to have the adaptable reserve policy in lieu of a designated emergency fund, you wouldn't have both. It would be one or the other.
For the emergency fund, you would typically only have one or the other, but some of our clients have a designated reserve for, say, like PTO or, you know, for, you know, one particular thing. Sometimes they have a designated reserve that's a specific amount for, let's say they've been kind of working towards building a building, you know, so they designate the reserves, or we're kind of building this little pocket up for some sort of building. And then when it gets big enough, then we're going to build it. So that could be a designated reserve as you grow it. And then you have this separate from the emergency fund. But an emergency fund is typically one or the other.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question, Councilman Tungle.
Yeah, on the legislative permanent fund, we discussed about, we were putting $40 million on a permanent fund. What's the difference between just a permanent fund and legislative? But I did not see the money being tied up on that.
So, permanent fund is, this is where the bankers and the accountants get kind of mixed up. There's an accounting term for permanent fund that means legislative permanent fund, meaning it's restricted externally, vote of the people required, or, you know, some donor gave you this money and you can never access the corpus. So in an accounting term, permanent fund means legislative. APCMs manages permanent funds, but they're often actually sustainability funds. It's just they use the word permanent fund because that's in their title of their company. I think they, you know, bankers like to call them permanent funds because they take the money and they set it aside and they invest it differently with a different investment policy. But an accounting permanent fund is a legislative permanent fund. What APCM was talking about is more of a sustainability fund. In an accounting term, it's typically tracked in what we call a special revenue fund, because it's generating its own special kind of investment income.
Thank you. We just want to make sure it's not being tied up on the legislative part of the permanent fund.
Yeah.
More of a sustainability fund that we're doing.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, I'm a little selfish because I'm an accountant, so I kind of go on that side of things, but I'd encourage you not to call it a permanent fund. You know, if you called it the City of Onalaska Permanent Fund, it gets really confusing in the accounting world because the accounting term for permanent fund means legislative. So there are a few people who have them called permanent funds, but we actually call them permanent fund, special revenue fund, which is just kind of silly. But they call it the permanent fund. Legally, at least the example that I saw that APCM provided is not under the accounting rules, would not qualify as a permanent fund.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, continue, please. Thanks.
Yep. So I've provided a few examples. Actually, I would like to show you this just because I'm a numbers person. I ran a few things for you. One is when you look at your total general fund balance compared to your expenses, you have about 40 months, 41 to 43 months of expenditures available in your general fund balance. So if you take out what's restricted or non-spendable, it's really 39 to 40 months, which is about 3 years, just over 3 years. I think generally speaking with my cities, I see anywhere between 1 and 3 years in the general fund. Anything below about 9 months, I start getting a little nervous and advise people to be, you know, cognizant of that and be careful with their general fund. But you do currently have just over 3 years of fund balance in that kind of unassigned, assigned, or committed fund balance. Note that that does include the $25 million that you already have set aside. So that 3 years includes that $25 million. But I thought that might help with just providing some context. I've also provided for you some examples of fund balance policies from other cities. So, you know, for example, to answer one of your questions, you know, you can have this calculation in here. This one's based on budget divided by four. So they kind of said we need 3 months in working capital plus another $2 million for emergency. You know, we just think 3 months is not quite enough. So let's do 3 months plus another $2 million. So they kind of have right there, when you look at that policy, it's kind of this adaptable reserve plus another $2 million. So they kind of combined the two categories. And then this one is kind of fun because they said for budget stabilization, they want 3 months of budgeted general fund expenditures. But then they also have this operational and capital contingency reserve, which is another month, with different policies about how they would remediate it if it doesn't make that level. If the balance falls below that, then they have a plan in place to get it back to where it needs to be. And then this is a couple other fund clients. This one has a sinking fund. A sinking fund is where you kind of squirrel money away until you have enough money to build something or to do something. They have a sinking fund. This is in Sitka for their public infrastructure. So they squirrel money away as part of their budget until they have enough money to, say, replace a sidewalk or replace a public park or a parking lot. So they kind of use that as a sort of a pool until they have enough. But then they also have kind of the ability to access it if there's an emergency. So they kind of keep it into this infrastructure fund that's used for capital as they need it. So that allows you, let's say you need, set aside, say, $1 million a year, but your project you think you're going to want to do is more like 5 years. So you can kind of save money into that. And then when it hits that 5 million, then you transfer it out and you do your $5 million project. It's sort of a way of setting money aside, but they also have this ability to do an emergency transfer if they needed it. But for them, they have in here an approval of the supermajority. So they want, okay, if we're going to do that, we want everybody on board, right? So I kind of just wanted to give you some examples from around the state. I hope, they're useful. Again, I think this is all part of a strategy. A policy comes out of a strategy. So when we kind of talk about strategy and what's next here, I think it's important for the council to really think about what's your goal. What are you trying to achieve? And define that. Is it sustainability? Is it making sure you have enough for working capital? Is it important to have an emergency reserve? And then do you have these sinking fund goals, these project set asides that you want to kind of build up for? It makes sense that we build up money for a utility replacement or some big port project we know is coming down the pike 30 years from now. Maybe it's some combination of all of those. The next step in a good strategy is just getting good ideas from the council and from management, from your directors. What do we think we need in reserves? What makes sense to put into a sustainability fund? How much would you feel comfortable with? And then you assess those options. When you look at the options we covered before, does it make sense to use all of them? Does it make sense to have, two or three of these? And what levels? And then propose a policy. So this is where, you as a council need to ultimately approve that. But really, it's usually best is to kind of set these principles for management. Hey, we want to make sure we have approximately this much, or we want to, get your recommendations. Ask management to propose this policy based on the guiding principles that you provide. So the council would provide principles. We want to make sure we're sustainable. We want to make sure we can address an emergency, all of these things. But the council doesn't necessarily need to make the decisions about the exact amounts, rather providing those principles, those guidelines for management to come back to you with a proposal. Certainly you can adjust the amounts at that point, but giving them the guidelines of what you're looking for so that they can come up with a policy that makes sense for you to consider. And then once it's in place, once you have a policy, you do want to do some things to make sure that it's being put in place properly. So you monitor that. Financial statement and the annual audit is a good way to do that. But also throughout the year, looking to see when you're approving budget, for example, do we have that set aside that we know we talked about? Is this in line with the policy that we set? And asking those questions of management so that they can give you that information. Really, that's all I had, overarching for the process for setting a fund balance policy. I'm happy to answer any other questions and work with your team as they move forward to develop a policy for you to consider as a council. But I just really appreciate giving the chance to be here with you today and happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions for Joy? Councilman Tungle?
Yeah, we got a process they call a CMMP that's looking at 10 year ahead. I think that's kind of part like a policy that the team put together in here in the city. And we look 10 years ahead and all the projects are input in there. And we kind of put money each year for all those projects. Is that something like a policy you're talking about?
Yeah, and that may be something that you want to consider using a sinking fund for, or I know that in the past, Unalaska sometimes built up money in capital project funds. So you transfer those monies over as you receive portions of grants. Maybe you have different phased projects where you know you're going to do some big project and you've got enough funding for engineering. So you would transfer that over. But it can be a combination of both.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Councilman Bell.
Mayor, I have no questions. I do thank you for the presentation. That was good information. And different ideas. And we started discussing moving forward. I think it'll be great. And I think we'll end up with a good sustainability and financial plan in the future. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Councilman Luby.
Yeah, I want to thank you as well. You cleared up a little bit of terminology. Terminology is always confusion. You know, it creates confusion for a lot of people. And so I want to say thanks for clearing that up. And then I just wanted kind of your opinion on the sinking fund. If, you know, if we had a project we wanted to, if we wanted to put monies into a special fund for a sinking fund to do projects later, would you recommend that?
You know, people have different opinions on this. I think that having a good capital plan in place, especially if you have aging infrastructure, is really helpful because it kind of sets the stage for both the, you know, people in the community, but also for future council members. So sometimes people who aren't familiar with financial statements might see, you know, $60 million. Oh, well, we can do whatever we want. We have $60 million. But really, if you've got a good capital plan or, you know, fiscal plan in place, well, yes, we do. But we also have all these goals for the city, and this is going to help us achieve them. And so I think sinking funds are rather underused. But it can also be a little bit complicated for your team. I'll just be honest. I think sometimes in doing that, you end up creating a lot of make work for your team to track all of these things. You know, it can be a lot more detailed than it needs to be. And I don't know how much value that adds. I think what I see being maybe a little more valuable is either a sinking fund or like a set aside based on a capital plan. So if you've got a 5-year capital plan, you would do kind of a set aside based on that capital plan. That's more like a this amount per year. And so it's the total of the capital plan instead of this is set aside for this item. That, you know, you can get really muddy on the financials if you have too many specifics rather than just a capital plan. And that includes these 6 projects or these 12 things that we've already approved separately. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And so currently we have our 1% fund, which is, you know, generated from our sales tax. So during our budget process, if we were to maybe, you know, add money to that fund so that we have more money available for our, you know, capital projects, would something, you know, it would be more generalized. It wouldn't be for a specific thing. Would that, you know, would that be a better way to go than to have everything broken out for individual stuff as far as staff goes and for audits and everything else?
You know, that's a great point because you do have this 1% sales tax special revenue fund. I think that's what you're referring to. And you essentially already have that $8 million. This is as of 22. So I have to look at the number for 23. But you already have that $8 million set aside for capital projects. So you're essentially already doing a sinking fund with that money. But that's just money that's generated from the 1% sales tax.
So I guess if would it be an issue to add money from our general fund during the budget process into that 1% fund? I know it wouldn't exactly be 1% anymore. And so the terminology 1% fund might be confusing, but that's kind of where I was going, is more of a general fund. If we wanted to add additional money for the capital projects, would we put it in that 1% fund or would we want to create a separate fund?
Actually, you can't. This gets probably more detailed than you want to know, but you would just put it in the same category, but in the general fund until the capital project is realized. You can't actually just accumulate money into a special revenue fund from the general fund. It has to be generated from revenue. But you can hold money essentially designated or committed for capital projects in the general fund until such time as those projects start happening. And then you move them over to the capital project fund. So then it would be tracked in what, you know, like into this fund, actually, as long as the project is kind of slated to start.
Okay, that totally answered my question. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, well, thank you for your presentation. We have no further questions at this time.
Mr. Mayor, I did one comment to kind of wrap it up. As Mr. Honk and I were working with Joy on this presentation, she offered that BDO does have a special services division that can work with us on this policy development. And I think that would be a really smart way to go rather than us trying to put it together on our own. Yeah. So I just wanted to put that out there that Joy had let us know that they do have that special services division.
Okay. And,
I think that might be a real prudent way to go.
No objections, we'll do that. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great meeting.
It's great.
Yeah, next item under our work session is a presentation from PND Engineering regarding Robert Storrs Harbor Improvements. I'll turn it over to Marjorie to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I'm going to ask Peggy McLaughlin to come up and kind of introduce this topic. And then she'll introduce the gentlemen who are going to be speaking to you.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. It's really exciting to be here tonight with this group of engineers. This project has been in the works for a very long time, as you know, and we were able to dust this off, this 10-year concept design, dust this off in earnest starting in December once we got the approval for the submerged tidelands from Department of Natural Resources. So that was the catalyst to get us rolling. P&D Juno with Dick Somerville as a principal had started the concept design back with us in 2012, somewhere in that time frame. And so we dusted these off. He has brought out his team. Brandon Ivanowitz, did I get that right? Okay. I tried to get the correct pronunciation. He'll be presenting on behalf of P&D tonight and also with P&D engineers as Morris Engineering Group. They're the electrical engineers on this job, and that's Mark Morris and Brian Myers. So I think it's going to be Mark and Brandon that are sitting up at the table here and going over the design. We're at a 25% level with the design, and I think they're pretty excited to tell you what's going on.
Yeah. Test. Okay. Okay, again, well, my name is Brandon Ivanowitz, and I'm a civil engineer with PND Engineers. And first, I'd just like to thank Mr. Mayor and the council members for having us here and allowing us to present today. And of course, to Peggy and the Port and Harbor staff and public facilities staff who have been super welcoming to us and just really, really coordinated with our efforts so far. And we could just tell that you guys have a staff that's really going to set this project up for success. So with that, I'd like to just get into this 15-minute presentation and show you guys where we are with things. So I'm going to kind of skip through the introductions. Peggy kind of did that for us with Dick and myself from P&D and Mark and Brian from Morris. So really have five bullet points to review with you guys tonight for the objectives. So the first, we want to go over the planning process and project status to date. We want to go over the scope of work. That's the uplands expansion and the reconfiguration of floats A and B. We want to review the project schedule, the project budget, and then we're going to stay around till Do we answer your questions, hear any of your comments and suggestions for moving forward? So the project status to date, Peggy touched on some of this. So digging back way back to 2014, there was the very in-depth planning and concept development process that featured a similar process to what we're doing tonight. Dick and Mark were actually up here and presented at least a dozen concepts for floats A, B, and C floats. At that time, the council selected a preferred alternative for replacement of floats A and B, as well as C float. And then in 2015, C, or the Discovery float, was replaced. We know A and B have not been replaced yet due to funding and capital improvements priorities, but A and B have been in service for another 10 years. They've continued to wear and degrade, and their replacement has now risen to a priority. So July 10th, 2024, the city issued P&D and notice to proceed for design and permitting services on the project. So for the last 2 months, we've been preparing the documents that you'll see tonight, as well as the 25% plan set that you guys have seen as well. And then on August 9th, Peggy and her staff submitted a State Harbor Municipal Facility Grant application. And September 10th, tonight, we've submitted our 25% design submittal. Today, we held an open house at the library where it was a really, really good review session. We had a dozen or so members from the community come out, give us input, and review the entire scope of the projects. Had some really good input on layout of the floats, as well as utility and power needs on the floats, and then some of the priorities in the uplands regarding the paving and layout of the area around the restrooms and the size of the restrooms. So this first schematic is the existing conditions, and I won't spend a ton of time on this because you guys have all been here, but on the left side of A float are the 362 foot fingers. On the left side of B float are 342 foot fingers. Then there's side tie all the way around the headwalks and mainwalks. There's a 50 foot long gangway down to the floats, and there's room in the uplands for about 18 passenger stalls. And running, I just want you to follow this yellow line I'm trying to hold steady across. This is the top of the embankment slope right now. And I want you to just keep that in mind for the next slide. This table in the upper right-hand corner is the existing moorage summary. So this shows those 42-foot fingers. There's a total of six slips of 42. The 60-foot fingers, there's a total of six slips. There's side tie capacity of 600 lineal feet. And if you add that all together, there's 1,200 lineal feet of moorage on the floats. And I just kind of put that chart together because the biggest thing we heard during the concept development phase was that there wasn't enough moorage, and the intent was to increase moorage capacity in the replacement.
Brandon, do you think you could reference this one over here? Christmas drink in our next year to try to look at this. And Siren, really appreciate.
Yes, I can. Yes, I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
So this was that yellow line I wanted you guys to reference in the next photo of the improvements. So this is a concept that was based off of concept 7A. That was the dozen or so concepts that were prepared in 2014. So starting in the uplands, what you'll see is an increased capacity for passenger vehicle spaces. So there was about 18, or currently is capacity for 18 passenger stalls. Under this new and expanded layout, there's capacity for about 31 parking spaces at the top of the uplands. And how we're really doing that is that yellow line I was asking you to follow. That's the shoreline of the existing bank, and the improved site has an offshore fill of about 30 additional feet coming seaward, and has allowed for additional parking in the uplands. On the seaward side of that parking is an 8-foot wide concrete seawalk that runs all the way around the bar and then connects to the roadway on the east side of the site. At the top of the gangway, there's a loading and unloading zone and accessible parking space. This brown box is a location for dumpster storage, which that could be located anywhere along the upland side. And then this blue box is a 20-foot by 20-foot pre-manufactured restroom. Coming down from the loading zone is an 80-foot long ADA compliant gangway. There's a gangway landing float and then a 10-foot by 292-foot headwalk float. Off of the headwalk float is a 300-foot by 10-foot wide mainwalk A. On the left side of mainwalk A are 10 26-foot finger floats, and on the right side of A are 7 32-foot long finger floats. On B float, on the left side of B float, are 4 62-foot long finger floats, and on the right side of B float are 2 8-foot by 60-foot finger floats. On the end of B float is this big T float that's 112 feet long. It's also 12 feet wide for transient vessels. Up in this moorage summary table shows all the additional stalls that have been provided in this layout. So the 26-foot stalls, there's 21 of those. 32-foot slips, there's 15 of those. 42-foot slips, there's 10 of those. There's 6 60-foot slips, 440 feet of side tie on the headwalk float and on the T float. And that totals 2,246 feet of moorage. So showing those numbers compared to the previous page of 1,200 feet of the existing conditions almost doubles the moorage capacity of the facility. The next few slides, I showed some photos of comparable past projects. You know, I could have showed you the black and white drawings of these, but I think the photos of some comparable site features tell a little bit better story. So this is the gangway that's currently at Discovery Float. So it's an open aluminum gangway with no roof, but it's it's 80 feet long, has handrails and an ADA compliant fiberglass deck. There is a lighting rail. It's kind of cool LED strip that's hid underneath the handrails. So it has lighting underneath the handrails for the deck. The floats. So this design would be similar to the Discovery Float with it's a steel pipe with an HDPE pipe pontoons. The organization of the design contract is that this is a design build component of the project, wherein PND will prescribe performance criteria and overall layout requirements of the float. So we'll describe the length and width of the finger floats, some of the desired features like the decking, the bull rail, but the final design and structural calculations of the floats will be performed by the successful contractor who selects their fabricator. On the left side, this is actually Discovery Float. So we would have an open metal grating, a steel pipe bull rail. On the headwalk, there would be piles internal to the float, although on the headwalk A and B floats, we would just have one pile on the headwalk internal to the floats, so more walking room. This middle slide shows one of the finger floats that would have UHMW rub strips. This float is actually a finger float from Carl Moses. The only difference at Carl Moses being the pipe pontoons are steel. A and B floats will use an HDPE pipe pontoon, which is desirable because the HDPE is plastic. So below the waterline, there'll be no steel components on this float. All this structural steel will be at least 4 inches above the waterline. So no structural or steel components below the water to rust or corrode. And on the right side is just a, this is some of the manufactured floats for Carl Moses down in the Seattle area before they were shipping. It's just a pretty neat picture of those all assembled and ready to go. The float utilities. On the left side of the page here is one of the freeze-protected water pedestals. So what freeze-protected means, you can use it year-round. It won't freeze. Inside of this pedestal, there's the one-inch water pipe, and that one-inch water pipe is wrapped with heat trace, and this pedestal is then insulated. So these are down at the Discovery Float, and it would be a similar water pedestal that would be usable year-round. On the right side of the page shows the fire suppression inlet system. This would be a dry fire system mounted on the floats. And this shows a comparable project where these, the fire department would come down in the event of a fire. They would locate the hydrant. They would charge the inlet system from an adjacent hydrant. The inlet system runs down through a pipe network onto the floats. And then there's independent fire pedestals located on the floats. This next slide shows the water and fire plan schematic. So this shows design criteria for where we laid out the water pedestals. So our design criteria from the municipal staff was they wanted to locate enough water pedestals that the water would be available within reasonable hose lengths to all customers, but that there weren't so many pedestals that they were a maintenance item and also caused clutter on the float. So we settled on three water service pedestals for both A and B float. And those water service pedestals are these blue dots. So each one of these three blue dots on A float and on B float would be one of those dual pedestal bibs, the black freeze-protected bibs I showed in the previous slide. So these are spaced. This is about, 60 feet in between these two. So with the 50-foot hose on most of these, you can pretty much reach into your vessels. There's also be one water pedestal at the north, at the far end of the headwalk float by the fish cleaning station, and then one along the headwalk. The red little boxes would be the fire standpipes, and we're limited to locating the fire standpipes. We have to meet the fire code requirements, so those are spaced every 250 feet. And then the float utilities, Mark's going to go through these for a few minutes.
Thanks, Brandon. Yeah. You folks are a patient crowd. Again, I want to echo our gratitude for you folks making time. And I have no idea how hard councils work until I come to one of these council meetings, and you guys have so many different things to deal with. A little bit about myself. I grew up in Juneau, worked on commercial fishing boats starting at age 7 with my uncle through college, and now our family has pleasure boats, and I've recently become a grandpa. And so my perspective on harbor electrical has changed over the years. I want to start with the lighting. This grandpa wants to keep track of Weston Ray and Shepherd Lane as they ricochet down that dock. And those kids move so fast that I want to have real good continuous lighting like this float shows here. Because if you have blotchy lighting, then it is hard for your eye to transition from the bright to the dark to the bright. So we have lights on these galvanized poles where the power heads are mounted. And let me see if I can run the pointer. Oh, where's the pointer? Brandon, you're good at this. There it is. There's the pointer. Okay, so you have a power head on each side here. That's what these little puppies look like. And one side, you see this galvanized pole that goes up. So we put this is about a 15-foot pole, and we put lights on it. Lights are also great for security. Lights are always really good for reducing damage to your floats, because if the captain can see the bull rail, the float real well, when they come in, they tend not to hit it. So keeping the glare down in the harbor is great for the vessel captains when they're bringing their boats in, because if it's all glary, then you have a hard time seeing the float because you're blinded by the light. It's also nice in the uplands to look out and see the floats and not have the light shining back in your eyes if you're checking on your boat or the harbor staff is checking to see if any boats are listing. The power pedestal over here on the left, you'll notice, is elevated off the deck. This change has occurred in Alaska's harbors because we do have commercial harbors. We always have a mix of commercial and pleasure, even in our pleasure harbors. And it's amazing what fishermen bring down these floats. And almost nothing that fishermen bring down the floats is conducive to ricocheting off these lightweight 316 stainless steel pedestals. When we mount them on the deck, they tend to get hit a lot. But you can run any dock cart you want into that hot dip galvanized post right there. It will smile and your dock cart will not. Also, if a captain or a well-intentioned crew member throws a line around a deck-mounted pedestal and then the captain backs down to pull the stern in when you're coming in the wind. We were told many times today during the public involvement meeting over at the library, gets a little windy in Dutch Harbor, right? So that is also really hard on pedestals. So, oh, well, that was nice. Oh, there we go. So that's why we put them up on those hot dip galvanized posts. Each power head has some doors on it, and that is so you can plug the cord in, close the door, and lock it. And we have a loop down there to put a padlock in so the doors don't fly open when it's windy. The key here is your cord dries over time as it's plugged in. Then you get less arcing on the cord surfaces when they're plugged in, and the receptacles last a lot longer. It's also easier on the cord. This pedestal you're looking at here has two doors, and that's because it also has a three-phase plug on the bottom like you folks have at Discovery Float. We're always learning as engineers. We don't ever get it all totally figured out. So your power heads at Discovery Float, the three-phase plug is a big heavy-duty plug. We didn't think it needed its own little door. And then Petersburg let us know, yeah, you need that door. And so now we put the three-phase plugs under a door. You see this big door on the side here? This is to reduce frustration by the harbor staff when they have to maintain these. You open those two little quarter turn, which are lockable latches, and now you have access into everything inside for easy maintenance. The plate that holds the receptacles and the circuit breakers inside is usually what you have your maintenance issues with, a receptacle wearing out or a breaker failing. And so that is an easily removable panel. You don't need any tools to remove it. And it has cords that come off it onto some posts using metals that are not designed to create a chemistry set inside your pedestal. A traditional electrical terminal is made out of aluminum casting with a stainless steel bolt, and you put a copper wire in it, which is a perfect chemistry set for creating all kinds of things you don't want to have happen in your pedestals. So we use bronze and brass, as well as tin copper, because they don't corrode with each other. So what we're trying to do with all of this is create an electrical system that will last as long as the floats. By getting the floats up out of the water that Brandon was talking about, We want to see about a 50-year service life with the floats, and we want the electrical system to last just as long. We use 316 stainless steel because it will never corrode. 304 stainless can be deteriorated by the salt. That's a picture of Discovery Float before we tied up any boats. So you can see from the uplands, you can look out there and see what's going on the float for security, as well as keeping track of the boats, no glare coming into the uplands. This is the design that we've been given so far by the city staff. I'll echo Brandon's comments. We had a phenomenal review with the public today, and one of the common themes was maybe a little more power. One member of the public who has a boat down in the harbor introduced himself, and he says, "Mark, I have a problem with what you're doing. I want to see a little more power down on that float." So don't shoot the messenger, but you can throw Peggy under the bus, but don't throw me under the bus. And where's my pointer? There it is. There it is. So we've got three pedestals on B float, and each one of those, we've got a little schedule up here. It's hard to see, but each side would have both a 50-amp 208-volt receptacle and a 30-amp 120-volt. And then over here on A float, oh man, this pointer's hard against a white screen. It also has three pedestals on it, and each side would have a 30-amp 120-volt. So that's what we currently have. And then we've got lights. You guys probably have as much trouble as I am here. See, these are the lights. We've got 1, 2, 3 on A float, and 1, 2, 3 on the main walk or the head walk, and then 3 lights on B float. Same type of lighting we have on Discovery float. And that is a summary of the electrical system.
I just had a question on the electrical outlets that are going to be available. Will there be two different types of outlets, one for the marine plug and one for just a regular extension cord?
The National Electrical Code does not allow us to put regular outlets down on a float unless they are designated for special use and under a lock. So we can only use the marine style receptacles for the public.
Okay. I was just curious about that because sometimes people don't have the regular plugs, and so they just plug an extension cord for a good or whatever.
Yes.
Thank you.
You bet.
Got the clicker back.
Okay, and then in the uplands, this would be the pre-manufactured restroom. This the comparable photos. There's a two or three, four manufacturers who make these pre-manufactured restrooms. These are a couple of photos from RomTech. But generally what they are is a CMU or a concrete masonry unit pre-manufactured building. They build it down south at one of their fabrication plants. It comes up, shipped on a barge, picked up with the crane, and basically set in place, utilities stubbed up through it. They have dozens and dozens of different sizes, configurations, and then finishes available for these things. So I just picked out a couple photos to include. So what the current space that we have laid out in the uplands is a 20 by 20. And what you can fit in the 20 by 20 space is something that looks like this left photo. And this would hold four small restrooms that could be either unisex or designated male, female, and then have a mechanical room in them. And then on the right side, this is maybe a little bit bigger unit. This may have six in it, but this one just shows the difference really in the finishes. Like these can be a pretty, pretty basic unit, or you can get, you know, this has this nice timber frame shelter and then some cedar faux finishes. You know, all this stuff on the right is nice, but it does come at a cost. And then this shows the floor plan for a 20 by 20. So here again, four unisex restrooms, and then right down the center would be the mechanical room. So again, you know, looking at the, had some comments today, maybe four restrooms at this for this facility is a little overkill. You know, maybe it only, maybe two is only necessary, but we have the space for something comparable here. So project schedule, starting at the top, where we are today, in town having our public meetings, where we'll move forward. Our next task will be the 50% design submittal, which would be submitted to the city in December of this year. We would prepare our permit applications, which we're working on now, and submit those along the same schedule in December of this year. Moving forward with 95 and 100% design through July of 2025. And the big one here, receive project permits, that would come in mid-August of 2025. So about nine months of permit review. That's for the Army Corps permit, the biological assessment, the Endangered Species Act consultation, the DEC water permits, the state fire marshal permits, all of those permits. The project would then be advertised and awarded from July of 2025 to September of 2025. Once the contract is awarded, the contractor would design, fabricate, and procure the floats. There were 7 months for those, as well as order long material lead items like the electrical equipment. Then the contractor would be on site for construction of the uplands and floats from April of 2026 to October of 2026, with a substantial completion in October of 2026. Project budget. The total project costs at the 25% completion level is $14.2 million, and that includes everything that you've seen in the site plans. So all of the floats, all of the uplands improvements, the gangway, all of the electrical, the manufactured restroom, the design, the permitting, some contingency. All of that is included in this 25% engineer's estimate. The current funding sources, we understand there's been a council appropriation of $6.6 million to the project. And as a possible funding source, we talked earlier that the city has applied for a State of Alaska Harbor Matching Grant, and that's up for up to a $5 million match. So a potential total of $11.6 million right now. So 2.6 to go. And that's kind of the end of the presentation. So we would be available for comments and questions now.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. I got Councilman Tungle.
I got a question. On this design, we worked on design back in 2012, 2013. We spent a lot amount of time on that design. Is that design coincide with this design that you guys are doing, or is it part of this design is from the previous design in 2012, 2013?
Yeah, so. Excuse me. So this is the design level that we took it to in 2014 was the conceptual level. So this is an elaboration on the concept 7A that was selected as the preferred alternative.
Yes. Because we worked it out where all the tidelands and both docks on both sides of A and B float, so we make sure we stay away if any boats on those sides. And then we figure out the tideland. I mean, yeah. So this is part, pretty much a part of that design.
Yes, and almost identical.
Thank you.
Further questions? Councilman Coleman?
Yeah, thank you. First off, I want to thank you guys for having the public meeting. As a user, it was really a great chance to interact with the engineers and design process, and I'll be able to put our two cents in, you know. So then we kind of get down to the nuts and bolts of the, you know, the costs. And so that's why I get to put my big council hat on is, you know, that's a lot of money. And so, anytime you look at any kind of capital project or improvement, you have to look at how does it serve the community and the users. And so we've got a really big change and the amount of mortgage that's now going to be available. So I guess my question is, I know there's been a wait list for a really long time. You know, maybe it's for the port director, but is this going to meet future needs, future possible growth of the city? You know, because I do look 20 years down the road, and, you know, you said this was a 50-year, good for 50 years, you know, that's just fantastic. So does it, do you think it'll fit the needs for our future or for current wait list and the types of boats that are out there and then future needs?
So that's a lot of information in one question, but I'll try to hit the bullseye on this. Currently, the wait list that we have is a list of 32 vessels. We have 23 vessels that we have regular monthly moorage on. I don't have the breakdown of those regular monthly sizes, but that's not hard information to dig in and get. That includes those 23 vessels are scattered across A and B floats and also the Discovery float. So to be clear, I do have a breakdown of, you know, roughly what the sizes of vessels are on the wait list. We've got a healthy number. I think we've got 9 or 10 vessels on the 50 to 60 foot range. We've got, I don't know, say 10-ish in the up to 26 foot range. And then the rest of them kind of fall in that mid range of, you know, somewhere between 27 to 40. But there's kind of a smattering of, on the smaller side, we've got 9 or so. Mid-range, we've got another 6 to 8, and then we've got a healthy number on the 60 footers. When we looked at this, Councilmember Tungle was exactly right. This is a more detailed view of the concept that was developed in 2012 and 13, and then Discovery was, you know, we focused in on Discovery in 14. And when we did those concepts designed, we took into consideration what was specifically on the wait list in terms of length overall for vessels. So we, you know, when we get this built, with what we're working with today, is that going to hold water 50 years from now? I hope so, but there's no guarantee. But I can tell you that it does meet the needs of what's here today with some opportunity for growth and some different types of programs for our local users. So with all the linear tide, it's not necessarily a, you know, trusted to a slip. We can do things like summer recreational programs for our open skiffs and those kind of things where they don't, you know, the summer months where they want to not have to trailer their boat every time they get in the water, those kind of things. So the linear type provides a lot of flexibility. This meets the demands of what we're looking at today with some flexibility for growth. The idea that we would like to see that still meeting the needs in 50 years. I hope so. That's kind of what we're shooting for, but there's only so much room in the basin. And the other thing to, you know, Mark's point, Mark Morris talked a little bit about the electrical, and we've had some internal discussions. And then of course the public comment today brought out a significant amount of, you know, concerns about whether we were planning for enough plugs for vessels in particular. And so, We're looking at the cost associated with where we're at today with the electrical as planned, which is running, what, about $1.4
million? Yes.
And Mark kind of ran some preliminary numbers for us. If we were to provide power opportunity for all the vessels in the slips, and that would add somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000 to the project. Is that worth it in 50 years? Maybe so. So those are kind of some of the things that we're chewing on. The other thing that we learned in today's public meeting was when we started this concept design, Wallachick was still there. And with the dismantling of that old ways, it's kind of changed the way that the wind has always funneled down there, but it's really had a different impact on the harbor. And so we're having to take a look at what that might mean to A float, the very last section of A float, because I think that the way that wind funnels in there could have a different impact than when we originally worked on this design. So 25% design for the float system, they're going to take that to 50%, which is going to give us our pile placement and our basic specs of what we want in terms of performance. And that's what we'll go out to bid. And then whatever winning, whoever wins that award will complete, you know, the major components of that. They'll get the float specs built to our specs. We are taking the uplands to 100% design, because that's all your utility corridors. That's all your, you know, the pieces that we have to keep in line with what we have in terms of our system. So I hope that answers your question, Sherry, but I'm hoping for a couple others if you
want. No, thanks, close enough. It's just good to see the projections and the ability to meet future needs if it's there.
So
I just made a comment about your contingency, make it really hefty, because there's a lot of junk down in that basin.
Yeah.
So you start putting those pilings and looking for places.
Yeah.
Yes, we heard that.
And just a little FYI, year to date, we see something like 197 vessels through on the transient program. So.
Thank you. Councilman Luby, then Uncle.
Yeah, this question is, I think maybe it might be more for Peggy, but and electrical again, back to the electrical. And I mean, I think it's probably best, in my opinion, to invest in the electrical now while we're doing it. And especially on the bigger floats, you know, boats have bilge pumps. And if something was to happen, they're going to want that power. You know, even if they're not drawing power all the time, they're going to want that power. I think that it's important to have, you know, plugs for every vessel, especially on the larger ones. Maybe not, I mean, on the smaller ones, if they're skiff size or something, they might not need it one every once in a while. But definitely on the bigger ones, I think we should, you know, put the money up for it and just do it while we're doing it.
I would thank you for saying that. And I think the internal design team would probably really agree with you on that, but it really is something we need to be transparent on the cost with that.
Thanks, Councilman Tuttle.
Well, we are on the electrical. What kind of voltage are we providing on the tank?
What do we got? This is the electrical guru right here.
Sir, we're providing 208 volts, 208 volts. So the smaller slips, the 32-foot stalls, and probably the 42-foot stalls would have a 30-amp, 120-volt plug. And the 50s and 42s would have either a 30-amp, 120-volt plug or a 50-amp, 208-volt plug. And the reason why we use 208 volts instead of 240 volts is that is a three-phase power voltage. And so we can use smaller wire underneath the decking when we go down the float to distribute the power down the dock. So it saves you money.
It's pretty much 110, 208, three phase.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Any further questions? Comments? Councilman Bell.
Thank you, Mayor. I would just make two comments, and I would hope this moves along at the pace that is anticipated. I think we're on schedule. I just hate to see the cost of this keep creeping up the longer this takes. And my other comment, which would be more personal comment, is, you know, if we're the facilities, the restroom facilities, if we're building a $15 million, you know, dock facility, I think, you know, something that represents that cost better than just a square brick building for restrooms would be more appropriate to that facility. So thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Bell. Thank you very much for your report. Some interesting questions you had. Did you still have a comment period that's open, or are you just going to go with what you got?
Absolutely, sir. And we've got a 50% design and then a 95% design out in front of us. So we will be submitting those plan sets to you folks for review. So there is a lot more time for comments in this process.
Well, thank you. I'll agree with Councilman Bell about the costs. The longer we take, the more it's costing. And I would, at least 2018, we start talking about it, and then by 2019, they did something. But there's 2024 and 2026. It's the way it goes, but it's really jumped up our costs from the start of this whole project. Thank you for your comments. Anybody else? Then, Councilman Newby.
Actually, I was just thinking about those restrooms, and you know, if we didn't need that many actual toilets and sinks, maybe a shower would work good in one of them for, you know, transient. But that was a thought.
Okay, thank you. We finished our work session, so at this time I'll request a motion and a second to return to regular session.
I make a motion to return to regular session.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Longo and seconded by Councilman Longo. Return to regular session. Hearing no objection, we're back in the regular session. It's 7:38 p.m. Back in the regular session. Next item on our agenda is the consent agenda, which has two items. Absent a request from the council to move or one or more items to the regular agenda for discussion, the consent agenda is adopted without discussion and with a single vote. Made a motion to adopt the consent agenda.
Move to adopt the consent agenda.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Coleman, second by Councilman Ruby to going to adopt the consent agenda and without discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries. Resolution. First item on the regular agenda is a resolution 2024-38 appointing judges and clerks for the regular municipal election October 1st, 2024, and judges to serve on the canvas committee.
Sorry, Mayor, there's a consent agenda? That was a consent agenda. It's been approved. Oh. Regular agenda. Well,
regular agenda. So thank you. Skipped right into my page here. We are now on the regular agenda. Persons wishing to speak on the regular agenda must sign up with the city clerk. Anybody signed up? Has anyone signed up?
No, sir. No one signed up.
Okay, thank you. The first item is the review of liquor license renewal applications. And it's number 3290, Grand Evolution Hotel, number 4748, Harbor Sushi, number 1367, Harbor View Liquor Store. And the fourth one is 1185, Harbor View Bar and Grill. Council, local government body, has given the opportunity to object to application for liquor license. Staff recommendation recommends no objection. Anyone wish to make a motion at this time on review of liquor license renewal application? Hearing no motion, we'll move on. Move on to the next item. Ordinance 2024-11, reading approving zoning amendment for marine dependent industrial to open space district for approximately 300.396 acres bordering the south side of McLeese Lake. I have a motion and a second to introduce ordinance 2024-11, a schedule for a public hearing second reading on September 24, 2024.
I'll move to introduce ordinance
2024-11
and move it to public hearing and introduce first September 24.
Almost there. Almost. I have a second.
Second.
Second by Councilman Longo. I'll turn this over to the city manager, assistant city manager, Margie.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So this ordinance approves a zoning amendment on the south side of McLeese Lake from marine dependent industrial to open space district. This will impact about 300 acres of undeveloped land. The zoning change, which was recommended to council by the Planning and Zoning Commission, came about after a properly noticed public hearing and resolution of the Planning and Zoning Commission. The zoning amendment will reflect the present use of the land more accurately and recognizes the significance of the area's importance to our community members for recreational, cultural, and also for subsistence fishing. The landowner, Unalashka Corporation, supports the zoning change and did not lodge any protest during the Planning and Zoning Commission process. And staff recommends council follow the recommendation of the Planning and Zoning Commission and approve this zoning change.
Okay, thank you. Before we get any further discussion, I want to make known that I'm chairman of the Unalashka Corporation. And nothing to gain in this ordinance change other than being a shareholder of the corporation. Else wish to comment? Councilman Coleman?
Yeah, and just maybe kind of a more of a comment. I was just reading through the minutes. I guess there were no objections other than the comment made by Ms. Syverson. I don't know if there's anybody from the Planning Commission that would give any more insight as to the discussions, as to the pros and cons of their decision.
I call it Cameron Dean. He's our planning director, who's also a member of the commission.
Yeah, that would be great. I was just curious if there was any Cameron, more discussion that might be pertinent to this decision.
Hey, thanks for the question. There honestly wasn't a lot of discussion beyond what is discussed in the memo already. The Planning Commission asked us to bring this to them after they noticed that it was zoned this way when they're reviewing the state's overall tideline plan for Unalashka Bay and the waters around here. They wanted to recognize the importance of the area to subsistence fishing. And recognize its current use. It's not currently being used for like a seafood processing facility or harbor, which is what the current zoning designation would be for. And they just wanted to make it clear that that was their like current intent for the land.
No, that's great. And yeah, just recent in the subsistence board meeting they had, they really talked about those two tributaries that feed into the lake and how important those are actually to the sockeye spawning. So it's really actually, I didn't really realize they really went up into those areas. So important to maintain that habitat for them. Thank you.
Any further comments? Anyone? Okay. City Clerk, has anyone signed up to provide public comment?
No, sir. No one signed up.
Okay, I'll move on to restate. Shall the City Council adopt Ordinance 2024-11, approving the zoning amendment for Marine Dependent Industrial to Open Space District for approximately 300.396 acres bordering the south side of McLeese Lake. Motion and second has been made. I request a roll call.
Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Ms. Luby?
Yes.
Mr. Longo?
Yes.
Ms. Coleman?
Yes.
Mr. Tungle?
Yes.
Thank you. On a roll call vote of five yeses and zero nays, one absent. With this vote, the council has introduced Ordinance 2024-11 and scheduled it for public hearing and second reading on September 24, 2024. Next item is the item C, Travel Approval 2024 Geothermal Rising Conference, Waiakola, Hawaii, October 27 to 30th, 2024. Request a motion and a second. Send the merit to the 2024 Geothermal Rising Conference.
I make a motion to send the mayor to the 2024 Geothermal Rising Conference on October 27, 30, and 24. But if there's any.
I'll second it.
Moved by Councilman Tungle, seconded by Councilman Luby. Councilman Tungle.
Is it just the mayor or any council can go into this?
That's a council decision, sure. But I will point out that this travel was not planned and is therefore not budgeted in council's budget. There's presently $91,890 in your travel budget, but that was for all of the trips for the whole year. So if you're going to use up a significant portion of funding for this to send more than the mayor, that means other trips will not, you know, you won't have funding for future trips that were planned for the rest of the fiscal year.
Councilman Coleman.
So what, I did read kind of the agenda, but what is the main purpose? What is going to be the significant takeaway from this? I know that the mayor's being nominated to go, but I don't know if anybody from management can speak to that as to the significance of what, why are we going?
Well, I know that the city manager and our deputy utilities director are planning and attending. But honestly, I don't know anything about it other than what is in the council memo. It talks about this being the geothermal industry's flagship annual conference, reflecting the geothermal opportunities globally. It connects people from various industries, academia, government sectors, and the general public. I don't know anything more about it than what is in the memo for you.
Well, you know, quite honestly, I don't think sending somebody to a, you know, first day where they have a full day golf tournament is really good use of public fund. So that's why I'm asking, is because, you know, private industry, that's probably great. But when you're using, you know, public funds and you have an itinerary that includes, you know, a big part of meet and greet and golf, it makes me kind of wonder the significance of this trip. And so
I will say, not to interrupt, but Mr. Honka did just text me, and he said that we will also tour the plant there. There's apparently a geothermal plant there, and they'll tour that.
Yes, for 30 minutes. So anyway, yeah, so I'll... Yeah, it would have been nice to know the impact of, you know, more detail about why we're sending anybody to this, but I'll support it. But I'm hoping for detailed report on this and what we've learned and how we can use it going forward. So, thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Cole. I'll respond after Councilman Tungle does this part.
Does anybody from the trilateral group going on this trip too?
Yes, I understand that someone from the Kowalungan tribe, Mr. Price, and also Natalie Kale are going.
Any further comments, questions? Councilman Luby?
Wasn't, did I read something where the tribe was sponsoring somebody from the city to go? Is that Eric?
I don't know specifically. It says one member from each of the trilateral organizations.
Uh-huh.
So essentially that Mr. Homka is the member of the trilateral.
Oh, I see.
But, you know, whether they're going to pull down into that detail, I don't know.
So basically there's one person out of three that are going that will be paid for by the tribe.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
And Mr. Homka did add that our group is getting their own tour of the plant and that it would be more than 30 minutes. And then that's the same company that OCCP was working with on the geothermal project.
Councilman Bell.
The only comment I would make is, and it would echo what Councilman Coleman is saying, is not necessarily knowing what the itinerary is and what the benefit is that we're going planning to get from this. But the other question I would ask, and I'd direct this more to the mayor, is sending the mayor as a representative of the city of Unalaska. But are you also representing OC on the same trip? And if so, it would make more sense to approve travel for a council member or you know, another person.
Well, my understanding is I'll be traveling if it's approved for the city. Even if OC decides that they're going to pay my way, I don't even know if I'll go. There's a couple of issues that I'm concerned about, and that is the city manager being out during a possible visit of Patola. She may change her travel in a snap of a finger due to weather and come in 2 days early. And there won't be anybody here from the city leadership, specifically Bill. Right now it's, I didn't leave anything in why I don't really see any big deal. And I can always go there at any time and take a public tour. But that's up to the council. Like I told Marjorie earlier this evening, either way, it didn't matter to me. Long as Bill and the electrician, utility director, makes it down there and looks at what's going to happen if they deal with Ormat, who has the plant and where they're going to go look at and what's needed for land use. As I don't think anyone really has an idea in the city about a geothermal plant and what's going to be needed to operate it. Many of the users and participants of OCCP have experience and understand what's going to be needed. But I think it's a good idea that somebody take a look at what they're coming up against. That's all I've got.
Thank you.
Councilman Luby.
I would like to ask if there's any council members that would like to attend. If there's anybody, maybe speak up now.
Sure. I think after Councilman Tom Bell had mentioned, going out and using public funds, I don't blame council members for not saying, yeah, I'd like to go. But I think at some point, council members should have the opportunity to see a plant, to understand what they're dealing with. But this is the first contact with a major worldwide geothermal operator and Ormat. And I think it's important to understand what they do and how many sites they have and They are well aware of McCushion. They've been studying it for 3 to 4 years now. And they have a understanding of what it's going to take. Okay, at this time, I'll call for a roll call vote.
Ms. Luby?
Yes.
Mr. Bell? Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Mr. Nicholson? I'm sorry. Mr. Longo?
Yes.
Mr. Tongo?
Yes.
Ms. Coleman?
Yes.
With the roll call, what a 5 yeses and 0 nays, the motion has been approved for the city mayor to attend a geothermal rising conference.
Mr. Mayor, Bill Humpke has just now joined the Zoom meeting. Would you like him to speak about this conference? I'm seeing council member heads nod. So the clerk is asking Mr. Humpke to unmute, and he can explain more about the importance of this conference. Go ahead, Bill. We're waiting for him to unmute.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't think this was going to be such a long meeting. I just happened to get home and turn it on. I hear what was going on, so I'm glad I had an opportunity to speak. This is not something that I would typically want to go to for the very reasons and the tones that I'm hearing. I don't normally go to these nice places for splashy conferences. However, this is something that you're all going to have to be focused on more this fall. As you can see, I put down a schedule for a joint meeting. Hopefully you considered that. I don't necessarily think we should be pursuing a project we don't know a lot about. Haven't really talked to the people who build them. So this is that opportunity. I'm not looking for approval to go abroad. This is something that's domestic. There's a couple of ways you can dice it up. I heard Margie say, of course, you don't have the travel in your budget. Well, we could add it to one of those pesky budget amendments that everyone loves. So we do have money. And I think to worry about what's on the agenda in golf, I'm not going to even address that. I'm disappointed to hear that. I'll say that. Hopefully when I send directors and staff to conferences, I trust that they're there to learn something and do what we're paying them to be there. So hopefully you have that support for us. Are there any questions? Hello?
Okay, Bill, thanks. Any questions? Councilman Bell?
No, I don't necessarily have any more questions. Well, maybe I would direct one to the city manager and get a better feel for what direction he wants to go with something like this, and whether he would prefer to have multiple counselors go to try and understand the project here that we're, trying to develop, or if, this may not have the information that we're looking for, and there may be another conference or another direction we could go that we might be able to get better information, might get a bit of better understanding of how these geothermal projects work.
Understood. And honestly, I heard the part about, how is the mayor traveling? Natalie and I did have an opportunity to speak about that. And, the tribe is paying for one, one registration, the travel, and the lodgings for each someone at the city and someone here, or someone at the OC. which certainly is a nice offer of the tribe. It goes in hand with a grant that they have. I didn't want to propose a great big conference and travel going to Hawaii for the very reason we're talking, but I can't gauge what you'll get out of it, except I would like to see the inside of one of these things, or however you describe it. I want to talk to the people that operate it. I'd like to see what how it works. What did they not expect? Because they're in a much more populous area than we are in terms of supply chains, et cetera. And I think everyone will come away with a different perspective. So I can't predict what you'll gain from it. But again, we heard about this earlier. I kind of just rebuffed it because I really didn't want to be seen as, you know, living high on the hog on the public dollar. That is not the point here. The point is we're going to be investing a lot of public dollars, and it behooves all of us to be better informed about what we're investing in. So I don't even know where the next conference is, councilman, or I would say, hey, the next one is still in the States versus somewhere else, and I don't know. But I think it's timely because we are looking at, you know, movement, how are we moving forward on several fronts with power. Obviously, one is the co-op. One is what's happening with OC and CP. We're not part of that, but as they continue to separate, we learn, you know, how we're going to shape our relationship with OC. So some things are still tentative. It's one of the reasons I suggested, and I think Natalie and her board were very supportive of having a joint meeting. We meet in the public. They meet in private. I think we should, as a team, be able to meet together in public because, you know, this is a project for the greater public good. And I think it really helps the public to see that we can work together. But I can't say what you'll get out of it. I think I'll get a lot out of it. I'm sure you all will.
But. Well, thank you for that input. And I just would conclude that, you know, I have no issue with, you know, sending the city manager to go gain information and kind of learn from this. And, you know, maybe what we'll come back with is saying, hey, you know, the council needs to, you know, look in this direction or look at this direction to get more information and get a better idea of what we're doing. So thank you.
Thank you, Councilman.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Thank you, Tom. Any further questions for Bill before we move on? Next item 13, council directives to the city manager. Are there any directives? Hearing none, we'll move on. Other community input and announcements. This is a final opportunity to provide the council or make announcements. Are there any further announcements?
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Ben Wells with the Fire Department. Tomorrow is the 23rd anniversary of September 11th, and I'm here to invite the community to join local first responders as they walk side by side with UCSD students in the high school big gym while we simulate 110 flights of stairs that were in the World Trade Center. We'll begin the event at 9 a.m. We're asking that if community members would like to join us, that they are required to check in at the main office before proceeding to the gym. And we'll conclude around noon. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, Michael Sirica. I am pretty new to all this, but I'm reading this as input from a community member. So do direct me and let me know if I'm out of line or whatever. Obviously, you will. I'm sure you guys might know the September 5th EPA awarded $78 million to Alaska, Idaho, Washington, and one other state for clean energy. And I guess why I'm doing this is I just want to see why for the last 6 years we've been trying to do geothermal, why our lobbyists aren't in the right position and these people are getting it. Also today, Department of Partners with DOE partners with 25 coastal remote and island communities to advance local energy resilience. There was 6 Alaska regions, and we're not even one of them. And we've been pushing this through our senators and governors, politicians. I'm asking our local leaders, our local community members, local council, our tribe, our corporation. I think we need to start writing letters to these people. They know we want this funding. They know we've been trying for this funding, and we're not even on their radar. Juneau got a harbor for Coast Guard, for their icebreaker, or Sitka, I'm not sure. We're trying to be the northern trade route. I just have concerns that I think what we're doing, our management leaders need to go to these people and ask how they've completed the task that we've been trying for so long. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further community input or announcements?
I have one, Mayor. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services will visit Unalaska on September 16 until the 20th. So they'll do some naturalization interviews, biometric collection, and general information session with the field director of Anchorage office. And September 16, Mondays at 6 p.m. until 7:30, they'll have a citizenship information session at the Unalaska Public Library for individuals who would like to learn how to become a U.S. citizen.
Okay, thank you. Any further online or telephone?
No, sir. No one indicated that they have any other announcements.
Okay, thank you. This time we'll ask for motion to go into executive session, then we'll take a break.
I move to adjourn into executive session to discuss personnel and financial matters related to the PSEA contract negotiations, which if discussed in public might negatively impact the interests of the city. Present in executive session will be Mayor, Council Members, Acting City Manager Marjorie Meter, Police Chief Kim Hankins, and Fire Chief Ben Knowles.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Longo, second by Councilman Tungle to go into executive session. All those in favor say aye.
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 807. Objection? Hearing none. We're in the executive session at 8:09 p.m. And take a couple of minute break here.